Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, from one of my favorite bands ever, from 16, Bobby Ferry is here. Now, this is a band that I've loved for a very long time and actively collected, but still knew very little about. So this is a huge conversation for me. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. And he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do on this show. It's just a two-person team. Just him and I over here. So thank you, Tristan. Without you, it'd be a unicycle and I can't ride those. So you can find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damien or Twitter or Instagram. Also, there is a Turned Out of Punk TikTok page at Turned Out of Punk for posting these shorts that I've been making. You can also find them on the YouTube page, which is YouTube/@TurnedOutOfPunk. There's a couple of longer form documentaries that I've been making as well, and I will continue to make those. So thank you everyone who's checked those out, and I hope you like them. I just put up a new one last week about the time ICP, Insane Clown Posse, met Cold as Life. And you can watch that video over there on those platforms. The best way to support the show is by telling all your friends about it, letting them know, and subscribing to this and rating it if you want to. And if you do want to sponsor this podcast, please email Tristan. Let us know what you're thinking, because bills. Because bills. Speaking of bills, I play in a band to pay some of those bills. We're called Fucked Up. We have a brand new record coming out very soon called One Day on the Mighty Mighty Merge Records, home of Superchunk, home of Mountain Goats, home of Bob Mould, home of Tyson Dronicus, home of, oh man, actually a lot of my friends are on that label. It's a great label. And we are very happy to have this record come out. I'm very stoked for you to hear it. You can pre-order it now. You can find out more information over at merge.com, mergerecords.com, or over at fuckedup.cc, which is our webpage. And we've released some videos, including a new video, I Think I'm Weird, I Think I Might Be Weird, directed by Max McCabe Locus, who was on Turn Out of Punk a few weeks ago. So watch the video. It's synergy. Synergy, that's what we're working on here in Turn Into Punk. But anyway, check out One Day, our new record. I'm very excited for you to hear it. In stores, January 27th. Fucked Up will be coming on tour if you live in Edmonton or I think three other cities. We're going, it's a very short tour. I think Calgary's, we're playing Calgary and Saskatoon. I'm 90% sure it's Saskatoon. Anyway, find out those dates. Come and see us at those shows. You can find out all that information over at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's episode. Today on the show, as I said off the top, from one of my favorite bands ever, a band that I've loved. I remember first hearing about this band in Maximum Rock and Roll. There was just so much mystery. Like, their name was 16. The graphics looked amazing. Sometimes it would be cool old photos. Sometimes it would be pusset art. But there was just something about this band that drew me in. And then hearing their records, I say it to Bobby in this interview, there are songs on Dropout that, ooh, they got me through. That record, a lot of their records, all their records, including the new one, Into Dust, which is one of my favorite records from last year. 16 is a band that constantly evolves membership-wise. Bobby founded the band and then left the band for a second, then came back to the band. But the one thing that is always consistent is the power of the number 16, the band 16. I mean, it's a great number too, but the band 16 and that number, that's their name and logo. And anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. That's it. Check out Into Dust on Relapse. It's their latest album, came out last year. It's on a lot of people's favorite records from last year, which is great because I feel like this band is consistently overlooked and underrated by a lot of people because they're awesome. There's no other way to put it. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Bobby Ferry on Turned Out a Punk. Bobby, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. My pleasure.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I feel like, you know, being around music for this long and doing this podcast and playing in a band, I've gotten a chance to meet a lot of my musical heroes. You're one of the few I've never met. So this is like a huge thrill for me to get to do this with you.
Well, I'm a bit surprised, but I appreciate the kind words, of course.
Well, I think 16 occupies such a unique space in not just punk, but music. Like it's an island unto itself. And, you know, there's just so much mystique for me and just so much history. And I'm going to get through all of it, hopefully, or most of it tonight. But I got to start it off the way they all start off, which is, Bobby, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Literally 4 years old. I was brought to the skate park in Orange, California. You know, parents were never getting along, and my dad worked construction, and he would just drop me off literally as like maybe 5, 6. I got the photos of it, of me skating then. So maybe late 70s. And I was just left at the skate park as daycare, but also I demanded it. I am the man I am today because I was that kid at the, and I'm not that man. I'm not the man. I am that kid from that.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say. You know, like it was just skateboarding and then hearing, you know, Devo, Ramones, Devo, Ramones, X, Germs, Dwayne Peters used to skate there. Steve Olsen used to skate there. I might have became like 6 years old and I would hang out there all summer. Like every summer was just a local. And, I was okay. Well, I mean, I was actually probably really good for my age. But in my opinion, I wasn't very good. But, that's a lifelong thing. But just being exposed to those guys and the fact that, I remember trying to explain the Sex Pistols to my parents in their Volkswagen Bug, driving to like Alhambra, to the LA County Fair. And they were just like, this is horrible. This is not music. Like, we're worried about you. You know, we're worried about you. There's just no talking to me. That was my big imprint, the skate park, the lessons of gravity, the falling on your face, the having real experiences of courage and self-determination and challenge and injury. And then couple that with the older kids in skateboarding were not like a bully culture. I was a weird blonde haired, crooked teeth kid from California, which I probably looked perfectly in California. But, I never felt comfortable in my own skin until I was around that and heard, Devo, Black Flag, Adolescent, Circle Jerks, TSOL. And I grew up in Orange County. So those were the cool people to me. They weren't the athletes. I still, to this day, I can't. I've never been to a high school football game. I don't think I've sat through a full. I've never been to an NFL game. I can't throw a baseball. So my life was just this skateboarding punk rock. That's it. Till now.
But, you hear stories about, I think it's Tony Hawk has a story about the first time he met Dwayne Peters and he spat in his face. There was like an edge to skateboarding back then. Like, I guess you're so young, but did they take you under their wing kind of thing?
And nihilism, kind of like that Darby crash nihilism, that was a part of it. And that's why I think a lot of skaters get involved in hard drugs too, because there's just this, I already huck myself off stairs and pools. Who cares,
Yeah.
I don't think there's anyone tougher. There was definitely a nihilism to it. And that's kind of also attractive too, because that was like so different than Christian school.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess your parents, did your parents grow up in California, Southern California?
They didn't. Okay. I was born in Anaheim. My parents are from Florida and New Jersey.
I've been fascinated by California in kind of the late 70s, because it's sort of, it feels like that's sort of the emergence from the post-Manson era. Like, youth culture was so clamped down upon at the end of the 60s, and that it's really the skateboarding, the punks in the late 70s that kind of bring youth culture back to California in sort of like a rebellious kind of way, it seems.
Yeah, I think maybe, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you ever look at that show in Pomona, the Cal Jam, where like Sabbath plays, I mean, there was like, I know zero facts, but yeah, there was like, I don't know, half a million, a million. I don't, let's just say there was a fuck ton of people there. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was always filled with kids who were going to drive the culture. And it had that window. You're right. It had that kind of, you know, all the hippie shit that tore it down right there.
You're obviously getting into this stuff super young. Like, when did you start going to see bands play? What was the first band you saw play? Doesn't have to be punk even.
I saw, so, you know, my parents got a divorce when I was six. My dad got on a sailboat and, sailed away, you know, like into the distance, and went through the Panama Canal, and, you know, basically lived on a sailboat. And I would go with him for every 3 months.
Wow.
Go long-term sailing. And, you know, we would listen to music and have crazy, you know, fucking Tarzan adventures. But my mom stayed here, or not, I'm in San Diego now, but stayed in Orange, California, in Tustin. And, you know, she struggled. So she used to work the health food shows. There used to be a health food circuit, like street fairs, you know, the early farmers markets, mm-hmm, in LA. So we were, and she was also really into transcendental meditation, and almost to a damn near cult. You know, like we could have hit Charles Manson. We could have hit Scientology. We could have hit Timothy Leary. I'm serious, because, you know, we were hanging out in Laguna Beach all the time. We were hanging out with the Krishnas. We'd always have dinner at the Krishnas as a kid in Laguna Beach. And we were on, she was at Santa Monica at like a street fair. And I saw the 3 o'clock. The 3 o'clock are a great band.
Yeah.
And they were, and, you know, I just followed them around like a puppy dog, because they were playing the street fair. And I was literally like a 7-year-old kid with my Santa Cruz skateboard going all over the dock, you know, the boardwalk. And we were camping, you know, and I saw those guys, and they were super gracious to a little kid and let me sit on the stage. And I was just like, okay, now I want a guitar, and this is what I want to do. Like, this is it. This is it. You know, so I saw the 3 o'clock and just totally, you know, again, right there, I might've been 8 years old, you know, quintessential California, Santa Monica Street Fair, seeing the 3 o'clock while taking your skateboard around. And, you know, I had no front teeth because I fell on my face and the whole bit, you know.
Wow, that's awesome. Like, I love all that Paisley Underground stuff. And that 3 o'clock, those 3 o'clock records are amazing. It's such a great time for music in Southern California. Like, it feels like at the same time hardcore is happening, there's also like the Paisley Underground stuff. There's like the beginning of sort of that Blood in the Saddle, Los Lobos kind of scene happening too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like very vibrant, it felt like. Like, it must have been amazing to be a young person being into music that young and kind of taking it all in.
You know, you didn't know what you didn't know. I mean, I know now how kind of special it was. But then again, I think music is that special to begin with. So it could have happened at a Tower Records anywhere. Mm-hmm. I think anyone's, you know, I think anyone's experience could have been the same if you just had, you know, I mean, come on, you do music for your life. And it's just like, you know, succeed, fail, whatever. I'm listening to music like 10 hours a day, no matter what. You know,
yeah,
like, yeah. And I've been this way forever. Just, you know, it's my, what is it? It's my, you know, it's my nipple.
So when you're on the boat with your dad, were you taking any music on those adventures, or is it more just like survival on the open seas kind of thing?
No. You know, for a long time, he just went down to Baja, and we'd hang out in La Paz, and we'd cross the Sea of Cortez into this other city called Las Mochas. And, you know, we'd just have crazy fishing adventures. And, you know, I was reading full books. You know, I was 9 years old. I was just tearing through books. But the music we did have was I would tape K-Rock and KMET here in California for hours. I would just bring him tapes. And then every summer, he'd call me, hey, Bob, got you a plane ticket. And I'd literally get on a fucking plane from Orange County to La Paz. And then he'd pick me up and we go out in the dinghy. And, we just basically, it's just living, like I said, like Tarzan. Like, you just, like, what fish are we going to catch? And, and of course, he was like, there was other people in the cruising community that had music. Most of their shit was like Jackson Brown and stuff. But I got to dig on Jackson Brown. And it was so funny. They took me to a Jackson Brown concert in the fourth grade. And I dug it, so I like a lot of that shit now too, but of course, dude, living in LA or living in Orange County, it was K-Rock, it was Rodney on the Rock. Every Sunday you got to discover everything that just opened your world. And especially later, in like 1984, I think that all the British stuff became really good.
So what was so after seeing the 3 o'clock, were there bands playing at the skate park kind of thing too? Or because I know Dwayne Peters had, what was he had a band right around then too, right? That was on one of those Smoke 7 comps, I think.
I don't know. That really, I hung out the big O, and that wasn't his home park. But he was a scary fella back then, especially the kids. Like, he was definitely a famous skateboarder in our eyes, as famous as they got. I used to more idolize Steve Olsen and the style back then. But no, I was just exposed to music at the skate park through the speakers, through the speakers. And this was the dying end of the skate park era. So around 82 or 83, they all closed because of insurance. But then skateboarding, I think, got even better because then it turned into this pseudo outlaw activity. And then I think the whole crossover metal punk thing happened. And so that was really awesome too. So it was more of a dirty ditch skateboarding or backyard ramps, and Black Flag and DRI and all that,
So when do you, how old were you when you started going to concerts, right? Because you're getting into this stuff so young, right? Like at 8 or 9, I guess you're not really going to shows.
No, but very, very young. We were at fake ID literally when I was like 14 years old. That said I was 21. I look like nothing like 21. I named myself something hilarious on my thing. No, in fact, I was taken to shows in junior high, but not punk shows. Like I said, like Jackson Brown and things at Irvine Meadows, which was close to the house. Bigger yacht rock type things with parents and stuff. But when as soon as I got a license, I was 15, 16 years old, and the pro skater Ray Barbie and me were like, there was like four skateboarders at my high school, and Ray Barbie was one of them. He moved from Santa Cruz, and me and Ray got really into Red Cross, Neurotica, Dinosaur Jr. So my fake ID, I named myself Robert J. Maskus so I could go to shows. And I had a legit, like, we got like fake birth certificates, and then we would get tickets on these IDs skateboarding, like get trespassing tickets, and just be like, yeah, here's my ID, and Robert J. Maskus, and just rack up a bunch of tickets on it and fuck off. But I started playing guitar a lot, just skating and hanging out at Ray's. And Ray, I had a ramp, so Ray would hang out at my house, and it was the place. So anybody, we had guitars, Hondos and shit like that. And Ray had a super good ear and could already play lead then, so he would just park me on like two or three chords, and then he would solo, and we were like, 15, but we started going up to LA then to see, that was high school era. I really then I got really, I mean, I saw, I saw Rollins Band, I saw the Jerk Circle Jerks, I saw No Doubt a billion times because they played like every weekend. Sublime, we saw Sublime all the time. It was so funny because like Sublime, they'd play Huntington Beach, this place called Old World, and it would just be like a sketchy scene with fucking skinheads and shit. But Sublime would just come out with this good reggae vibe. There'd be fucking racist skinheads there.
So, like at that time, was the violence kind of subsiding at shows in Los Angeles? Because it's obviously so storied at this point, the mid-80s kind of violence and gang violence that happened at concerts and stuff. Had that kind of subsided?
Statistically, everything was way more violent back then anyways, if you look
Yeah.
at like the real timeline. But no, it was pretty violent. I was jumped either by gang members, like when I was like 12 years old, just for being in the wrong neighborhood skateboarding, just roll through the wrong neighborhood, just get fucking jumped and chased, or by skinheads, and then later on, when Fenders came in, there became like other punk rock gangs. And I'm not a violent person, I never was. Like I said, I've never even been in a fight. I've just been jumped a couple times.
You're a Jackson Brown fan, a peaceful Jackson Brown fan.
Exactly. But I have thrown some bricks through some car windows. So, there's that. No. The violence, Fender's violence was real. There was punk gangs, which I thought it was kind of nice because the skinheads were just the ultimate bad guys. If you're gonna get like jumped out of nowhere, it was always skinheads, And so when all the other gangs, there was the Lads, the LA Death Squad, and all these other gangs, and they were just, youthful, like, oh my God, they're here. We don't have to worry about the skins, Then the Reseda Country Club and stuff. But again, I was young and small, and I don't dig on violence. So I thought I, but I encouraged their violence. So.
In the late 80s, there's kind of the beginning of I don't know, like the more extreme side of hardcore that I would kind of put 16 in, like the Pessimizer stuff, I guess, would fall into that to me. But like the power violence stuff, Infest, No Comment, and those types of bands. Do you remember when that stuff started showing up, or were you going to shows or seeing any of those bands?
So I started 16, and I had like a super Steve Albini. I used to listen to that album Rape Man constantly. I just want to so I started 16 kind of on that band, like just super abrasive. And then meeting Chris Elder from Pessimizer Records, he actually gave me like a formal education the first time I met him. Like he's like, here's No Comment, here's this song Twist Down and Turn, here's this, I want you to listen to this, here's Terrorizer, here's Napalm Death, here's, like I'm saying, like he just opened his whole world. Literally, like I met him at KXLU in LA. It might have been 91 or something, but he turned me on to all this great stuff that I was kind of missing. Before that, I mean, I was definitely into Slayer and Metallica and things like that, but all this great stuff was happening all around me that I had no idea, like Excruciating Terror and Infest, but especially No Comment. I just loved No Comment. And
When 16 first formed, what kind of bands were you guys playing with?
same as now, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the thing. We never really fit into a scene. I don't know if we were seeing people, or if we threw a party. I don't know if many people would come. That, like, so I kind of wanted to make. I've always hated my home city, and for good reason. There's a good reason to hate Orange County, California, and LA. There's a good reason to hate it. But who were we playing with? Anybody. I mean, our first show was at a backyard pool. The cops came and broke it up. We played at this place called the Doll Hut. God, we played at this place called Bogart's, and we got like totally heckled, like speak, like yelling at us to speak in complete sentences. it was never really easy live until Jabberjaw, until Gary at Jabberjaw started giving us shows with, you know, Carp, with Hammerhead, with Unsane, with, you know, someone like that was just so nice to us, you know, and, yeah. You know, would put us on shows all the time.
It's such a cool venue. Like, I didn't really understand it or appreciate how important that place was till that book came out, and kind of flipping through that book and realizing, like, it just occupied such a key space for, like, yeah, these noise rock type bands, I guess, for lack of a better term, to indie rock type bands. It seems like a key transitional venue prior to, I guess, the alternative music explosion that would, I guess, change the landscape.
Yeah.
Why did you guys do a double 7-inch for the first 7-inch?
We had the music. Mm-hmm. The drummer at the time, bankrolled it. So it was just like, do it. And he had his friend who did graphic design. And I wrote the songs. Of course, like anything, we just threw it together. But through skateboarding, I was friends with a guy named O.
Yes.
O.
The legend.
Otis Bartholomew. Yeah. So O, you know, O's another person that really is critical. Like Gary from Jabberjaw and O is a very critical person in our history. For one, encouragement, like telling you, like, dude, kids, don't break up. You're doing something good. You know what I'm saying? Like giving you the speech I'm sure you've given to new bands. We're like, you guys are doing something really good.
Yeah.
And of course, you know that all the good bands break up in like a year. And then we look back and go, oh my God, that would have been huge. So put us together with a guy in San Diego who was recording, Tribe Like Jehu and Rocket from the Crypt and a part of the San Diego scene and all those ska bands, a guy named Jeff Forrest. And we went down there for our first studio experience. And that was that 7-inch.
That's the standard 7-inch or that's the double 7-inch?
The double 7-inch.
Oh, that's the double. Yeah. Okay. So I guess you met O before, like long before the standard thing happened.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I knew O literally since I was like 12 years old from skating a ramp in Westminster, California. And he took pictures for magazines. So if you were going to get a picture in a skateboard magazine, O is the guy.
It's so awesome when you think about like how disparate the world in San Diego, where you are obviously, but like the music landscape was in terms of all these different little micro scenes and all in punk, but O's like the link between all of it.
Yeah, we used to say, oh, like, I mean, it could happen any day now, you know, like I could go to the Casbah right now and he'd be there. And then I would go to this other place called the Whistle Stop and he'd be there. And then I'd go to this other spot and he'd be there, you know, like he's an enigma. But like he's an undying 50 years of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
The people that O has brought together is probably more than I know, of course.
Well, it's amazing.
And he turned a bunch of people on to a bunch of good stuff too.
Oh, absolutely. And when you go through that label of just seeing the bands he put out from like you guys to Rock from the Crypt to Phantom Surfers, like it just reflects the kind of range, I guess, of worlds that he's involved in. And but it's like it's all punk once again. Like he's, you know, from Olive Lawn to Fluff, and he's still got his hands helping out younger bands that are coming up, like keeping this thing alive.
He's doing it to this day.
Yeah. When was the first time you guys toured?
We were never really a big touring band. Our first like US tour was like 1997. We were all pretty economically unstable. Mm. You know, we were like apartment kids in Orange County. So having survival, even though it sounds funny because that's a super opulent place. It was pretty hard to survive, like just a place to live there. So as far as like picking up and touring, we never really, we would go to San Francisco, you know, we would go to LA. Those were our tours, you know, but not until, our second album, Blaze of Incompetence, did we actually attempt a full tour?
Did you, but you guys went to Japan at some point before that, right?
So, we went to Japan, and I guess I skipped over a big thing there. So, Pusshead wrote us a letter out of Maximum Rock and Roll and said, "I want you to be on my record label." And then we went and recorded like four songs for Pusshead. And those turned into the Crystal Seven. It basically what turned into our first album. And then, like 6 months later, he writes another letter saying, "Hey, do you want to go to Japan?" And so we did. But a tour of Japan is four shows. I don't really consider that touring. I consider like, we just did 14 shows in 14 days or 15 days. That's touring. You know what I'm saying? The grind of going for 28 days. That's touring. So honestly, we've only done that like since, I don't know, since like 2010.
It must be so weird though. Like, so Japan's like the first. Like, it's just 4 days. That's like is a tour, and that's normally the tour that like comes at the end of your career. And here you guys are starting out with a Japanese tour.
I know, huh? Oh no, it was a lot too soon, to be honest with you. I think developmentally, musically, it set a weird expectation because we really needed to go out and punish ourselves in the Gilman type scene of places, so we got to skip a step, but it didn't help at all in the long run.
Were you guys playing with any, like, obviously, Puss had put out some Japanese bands, but would you guys play with any of the Japanese hardcore bands that were happening at that time? Because it's such a vibrant time for that stuff there too, in the early 90s.
We played really, I think most of the dates are with this band called Concrete Octopus that had a I from the Boredoms.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we played with them. We played with another band called Coco Bat, which was Pusshead was on his label. So that's who we played with. But the shows were amazing. We were playing to Jabberjaw to like 30 people max. And then we go to Osaka and play to like 400 people. So it was like, what?
What was the scene you guys were kind of finding yourselves in America? Like, were you playing with, because obviously Grief's in Boston, but like, were you a scene, or is that more just like a label type thing, the Pessimizer thing?
No, Pessimizer, I think, came along with a scene when we started putting, when we put out Dropout on Pessimizer. We added Phil Vera, who would later go on to do Despise You and Crom and Trappist. We started playing with Pessimizer bands. So things got a little crustier. But it was awesome. I was into it all. Like I said, I got a really good education from Chris Elder, from Chris Pessimizer. So
Because your sound's there right from the first double 7-inch. Like, that's the thing. It's like the band, like you're saying, like musically, I don't know. You said something about not being fully formed, but I don't know. The band's fully formed from that first double 7-inch and just goes from there for me.
I have the gift of ignorance. Like I have this gift of ignorance and enthusiasm. I'm enthusiastically ignorant. And also skateboarding was a thing. There's a guy I used to skateboard and hang out with, a guy named Todd Swank. I used to ride for Foundation Skateboards when I was a kid, or my late teens, and as a sponsored skateboarder. And he was really into Sonic Youth. And we saw Pitchfork, the early Drive Like Jehu band, Pitchfork, and I was hanging around all those, that scene. And there was a premium put on effort over technique, and that's so like I just put effort, like that's and I think I still have it, but that's how the band's sound came about. Like I'm just going to force this out. I'm going to vomit this exactly like it is. And it's a blessing and a curse too, because I'm also every record or every song I write, I'm trying to tear it all down, and it sounds exactly like 16 every time. So whatever.
But I think that's the thing about it. That's like, I don't know, like when you talk about Johnny Ramone and how Johnny Ramone, you know, is one of the greatest guitarists of all time, but he always was doing Johnny Ramone. And that's like the auteur thing, right? Like you see a Hitchcock film, you know, it's a Hitchcock film. Like you want to have, if you're doing something unique and it's all to you, it's your own style, right? So it's always going to sound like you.
It takes a while to accept that though. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, because your ideal is always something different, and then you just let go of that expectation.
Yeah.
So. Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What you guys went on tour with Slayer super early too, right? You guys did some shows with them?
Yeah, like three dates at a time. Like a guy from Atlantic Records. This is when like band, you know, this is the Nirvana, everything's huge. It's like 95 maybe. But yeah, he definitely threw us up there. It's on like YouTube. Bakersfield and Las Vegas. I think we played with Slayer on the Divine Intervention tour. You know, we were just thrown up there. I think they kind of, we didn't have melodic vocals. Some of us had either mental illness and drug problems. So I think they wisely passed on us, you know, but we definitely got those opportunities, and it did it help? Like as far as like a draw or anything like that, no. You know, I don't know if they knew what to make of us with all the feedback and stuff, but I thought we killed it. You know, I mean, we didn't get booed off the stage. We definitely held it together. And you know, but you know, it would have been better if we did like 20 of those dates.
But I think it's one of those things where as long as you don't get booed off, that's the best you can hope for with like a crowd that's there like that for Slayer. It's like opening for Motorhead or something where, you know, you just got to hold your own. And like you're saying, you might not steal a lot of those fans away and make them your own fans, because that's just the nature of that beast, I guess.
Yeah. No, yeah, it was awesome. You know, I mean, we got to see, I'm a giant Slayer fan and was back then. And, you know, so it was mind, you know, melting.
Yeah.
We brought like all our friends with us, you know, our touring party was like 20 people, you know, and we didn't have a van. So we just had two pickup trucks. So we're literally following around a semi and a bus and trying to get paid by their road manager with like 20 dudes and like fuck, just a total shit show. You know, no, we didn't even have cases for our guitars. Like we're just a total shit show. And we definitely couldn't afford to rent anything or, you know, but of course it was awesome. How could it not be?
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, I mean, at this point, this story could have ended and we might be doing this podcast. Because that sounds such crazy life right there. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you went, you know, you played Jabberjaw and Courtney Love's there, and then you go to Japan with Pusshead, and then you open for Slayer, and you're like, the end.
And that's just like the first chapter of the band. Like,
yeah, definitely.
It's like there are few bands that warrant a book, I think, as much as 16 does, just because, like you're saying, there's it's real. Like, this isn't just like an act in terms of the struggles that are being sung about in the lyrics and stuff. Like, from what I've understood, it's something that the band has had to deal with the whole way through. As like a real mental health thing is a real thing. Drug issues are a real thing that you guys have had to deal with.
And you know, I don't know how it would have been any other way, though. I think we had that punk rock and skateboard bravado. And I think that you fall into risky shit that way. But it also doesn't make you the most stable, people.
Yeah.
Bottom line.
Well, and I think, like you're saying, there's like, especially to be presented with all these opportunities out of nowhere and just like have to deal with survival, but at the same, it's like a feast and famine at the same time situation.
Yeah. It was definitely, a lot of us had like no, parents to come home to or places. So you're just scraping by and living with, girlfriend or just fucking practice space, but still trying to hold some, shitty job as well, because you have to eat,
Yeah. When you guys, like, I guess being on Pusshead's label, Bacteria Sour and Pussmort, it's amazing thing because obviously the artwork and everything like that, but then all those records were really hard to get. Like, was that something that you ever factored into, or was that something you guys thought about when you eventually signed with Pessimizer, or is it just the relationship naturally ended? Because I remember as a kid, you could never get the Bacteria stuff. Pessimizer stuff had great distribution.
Oh, that was the whole thing.
Yeah.
We made that album Dropout 2 or 3 years before it came out. I think we arrived in a lower tuned sphere than a lot of bands. Because Dropout, I think if you listen to Dropout and go, wow, this is from like 94.
Yeah. That's crazy.
This is from 94 and it didn't come out to like 97 or something, or 96. And some of it was recorded in 92. So it's like, timing is everything. And the timing was very tough with him, because it just, but it works for him. So who am I to say, it definitely works for him, but that was a huge thing for us. And then we were just, we were brothers with Chris Pessimizer. He was one of us and we were one of him. We came from the same, socioeconomical, but also musical and kind of skateboarding background, so.
Yeah, like much in the same way with Standard, Pessimizer is like one of those labels that obviously everything's extreme sounding, but every band is fucking amazing. Like, it's really like a sub pop of heavy music.
That and his aesthetic of just, of this kind of weird negative humor, pessimist and miser.
Yeah.
that had me right there. But his humor, his zine, everything, he was, like I said, like, we were a part of what he was doing before I think we met each other. It was just like the same wavelength, even though I always think he's definitely a little cooler than me. But,
well, I think that, Dropout, people like will talk, people say like, oh, record saved my life. I think that record saved my life. Like, that record, at various times in my life, at real low points, I've turned to that thing in the way that people turn to the, like, a Bible. And it's brought me comfort in heavy, heavy times. So I'm glad it got better distribution in the end, because I don't think I would have gotten it potentially if it was on Bacteria Sour.
I'm glad it lives on Spotify. I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's there. I mean, we still play like three of those songs every time. They stood the test of time.
Well, but I think that's the other thing about the band is it's so fascinating, because like the membership has changed at various times, but the name has, it's always been consistent to the brand of this band being like, it's almost like the band is bigger than the people in it in a way. And I don't mean to diminish your role, obviously, in making this band, but at the same time, like it's almost like, I don't know, there's a power to 16 that just has existed for so long now over so many different lineup changes, but it's always been consistently powerful.
I think that comes from not being satisfied. And also we've always we put a real premium on sincerity. Mm-hmm. And I think when you put your emphasis on sincerity, hopefully you'll have that result. So that's, if we were a company, that is our corporate ethos. the premium is on sincerity.
Yeah.
Being for real, dude. Being for real.
Yeah. Sincerely negative is the ultimate motto, I guess, right? Like or do you think it is negative? Do you think the music is ultimately uplifting? Because I do, as I'm saying this, I've found it very uplifting at times.
No, I actually don't. I think there's a real telling it like it is. That's like a hardcore trope, but I think we got really good in telling yourself like it is. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think Dropout worked. There's a lot of lines that are relevant in kind of self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's nothing like, so what Dropout did for you, like Rollins Band, Hard Volume did to me. Mm. I remember being like, not suicidal, but like, definitely low points in my life, and listening to like Gun and Mouth Blues and just going, I fucking get it.
Yeah.
I'm going to push through. I'm going to push through this shit. And I think that's like, and also there's like kind of a peace in giving up. Like not everything is a fight. There's a go with the flow of the dirt.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think like you're saying, hardcore is all about honesty and sincerity, but there's very little honesty with oneself at times. Like a lot of it's living up to like an expectation that's an external expectation. And I think 16, like you're saying, there's always this sort of peeling back the layers and being like, no, here's how it is. And like you're saying, surrendering to, sometimes you can't change who you are, and sometimes you just have to be who you are for better or for worse.
Yeah. Accept your biology.
Accept your biology. Yeah, exactly. Like you're, and so much of it is like, be straight edge or be positive or be this thing. And there's a complete discounting of and an ignorance of the actual biology and chemistry that goes into mental health and goes into addiction and goes into all these things. Like, we're not just fighting our will here. We're fighting our genetics in some cases.
Hugely. Mm-hmm. Hugely. I mean, what do they say? The DNA just loads the gun.
Yeah. Very true. Like with it, were there bands that you felt like, cause you're saying it's a band unto itself. Like, were there bands or scenes that you felt like you could have been a part of, or that you were a part of with 16?
We were of course greatly influenced by the whole Amphetamine Reptile thing. Mm-hmm. But that was over before it started.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's such a weird little micro scene.
Not to say that Jesus Lizard, of course, transcended that. But like bands like Tar, Surgery, you saw those bands once and they never came back. And a lot of that. So if we were trying to be a part of any scene early on, that would be the one. And then after that, it just became like, I don't want to quote the guy because he's such a piece of shit, but I never want to be part of a club that had me as a member. there's this kind of disgust in yourself for wanting to be a part of a scene that I don't want to be a part of a scene. So fuck off.
But so much of like, quote unquote, making it or like having a career in the music industry is about this sort of like being part of a scene or being part of a community. And like, what do you do when you have a natural aversion to wanting to be part of this thing or like part of a thing other than the larger thing that we're all a part of?
Well, you know, but that's my angle, man. No, it's a problem for sure. It's definitely a problem. I have no regrets about it either. Mm-hmm. So I have this, it gives us a little bit of a staying power that we're not at the whims of a scene. We're just kind of going to be here.
Yeah.
We're going to occupy this little corner. At this point, I'm super happy that I just keep the same momentum of creating, and that keeps me super happy.
When you left the band for a few years, did you miss it immediately or did it take a while before you wanted to come back, or like, how did that whole process go?
No, I like immediately started another band. I got a job in San Diego. Like it wasn't like a big thing. Like I hate you guys or anything like that. I just was I was living in LA and I just wasn't going anywhere professionally. And so my friend that I mentioned before owned all these skateboard companies, Toy Machine, Zero, Pig Wheels, and Foundation, who I used to ride for. I got a job as like a sales manager at a skateboard company. And so I moved to San Diego and I always adored San Diego. So I was living in, a pretty rough neighborhood of Long Beach with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and she worked in East LA. And it was just a rough existence for us. Mm-hmm. There's no parking, there's fucking gunshots, there's, it's a pain. It's, there's no laundry, it's a struggle. So we got, I got a better job and we got to move to San Diego. We moved to this, fucking cool neighborhood called Hillcrest or Golden Hill. And it was just like, well, I'm doing this, so I'm going to take off, guys. And they're like, okay, well, can we have your amp? Seriously.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I'm like, you can have one of them. Only one. But then I just moved down here and started jamming with people immediately in the, making the same shit I always make. So I have to do it. And then I had a kid. So, I wasn't really in a hurry to be in a band.
Yeah.
Because, I got a mouth to feed, man.
So what made you want to come back to it? Like, was it like, did you feel like, obviously you're doing music the whole time, but to step back in there, what was what brought you back?
It was just, for one, at that point I wrote, let's say 70% or 75% of the songs that 16 had. And I thought I wrote the good ones. I wrote some of our, and also the band just kept like, there was like a tribute site on MySpace to it, and then it was like, well, let's just get it back together. Our friend was in this band called Wormwood from Seattle, our friend Larry. And he was like, just get the band back together and play Dropout. And, and like maybe like two or 300 people came and it was amazing. And then we're like, oh, we're a band again. That was it. And then we just, and then I wrote a bunch of more songs and then we got signed with Relapse. So it was just like, oh, here we go again. So we were only off for like 3 years, at the time. So it didn't lay dormant for long, but I guess it was kind of mine because I wrote the, I've, but it's kind of mine because I'm always the guy propelling it forward. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm like not a good guitarist. I'm an all right songwriter, but I'm the guy. I'm the guy that everyone's going to look forward towards. I'm just that guy, and that's cool. That's cool. So I'm that guy that's going to push you. We're going to write the songs or do the show. We're going to do something. So it just came back to me. like friends. I gave it to some friends and they did it for a while and then they gave it back to me and I still do it.
It's so awesome because it's like you look at bands like Fleetwood Mac or you look at AC/DC, you look at all these bands throughout history and there are like distinct eras of this band, these bands that like tell a story. And I've always felt that with 16 too, like the lineup changes or the shifts in the band, like it's always, like I said earlier, it's always going to be good, but it's always going to be slightly different in a way. Have you guys always had the same approach to writing LPs? Because very few bands kind of have consistent, coherent visions when it comes to an LP. And it seems like right from the get-go, that was the way it was with the band. Even though, as you're saying, they're recorded over sometimes years.
I am more of a chaos type creative. Like we're going to decide and get 500 feet away from this when it's all over, you know?
Yeah.
So there's no pre-planning on my part. But for the last record, the Dream Squasher and the newest one, Into Dust, Alex, our guitarist, who's been with us for like 5 or 6 years now, he's kind of a real visionary. Like I said, I don't consider myself a good musician or anything like that, but I can pick out talent pretty good. And I think he's co-opted the band into his own vision. and I totally welcome it because for one, I'm just bored as fuck of me. You know, of my, and so now I've gotten to move like 4 feet over to the microphone and play rhythm guitar. Mm-hmm. And then his higher concept of song structure or song choices in an LP is not left to chance, but I didn't really leave much on Dropout to chance either. I had a pretty good vision for Dropout even when I was a fucking kid. I was maybe 23 or something.
Yeah. Cause like, it does sound like a cohesive album, and like for a band that young doing like the second LP, it's pretty wild to have that kind of like grasp on it. Like you're saying, it's 94. It still sounds like it could have come out today.
It does. It's I think we've aged quite well, but then again, I don't really listen. The whole reason why this band works is the striving. Like I even listened to the LP today that I made while doing chores, and I was just all ugh. It's like I just made that last year. Like I gotta make some new shit, you know. I gotta come up with some better ideas than that.
It ages a lot better than Orange County Ska that we were talking about earlier.
All the way to the bank, man. All the way to the bank.
Well, that might have made more money, but still, I still.
you gotta live with yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny because like my wife will watch The Voice. And Gwen Stefani's one of the judges on it. And I just think like, oh man, she saw Instead and Inside Out. How wild is that? Like this is where it all went.
I know. I saw No Doubt fuck a million times.
Were those shows like violent, or is that kind of like the beginning of like the sort of, I don't know, like pop punk explosion at that point? Like were there skinheads going to those types of shows? Like you're saying with the Sublime shows?
The very tail end, but you know, the thing with the skins, I think in that area in Orange County is they turned out to be real bad guys. Mm. Like, you know, like real criminals who really went to prison.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't just a violent scene. That was like a group of guys that are probably no longer with us.
Yeah.
You know? So that was like 10th grade in high school. No Doubt was the place to go and fucking dance and just, you know, have a good time and try to meet a girl in a polka dotted dress. You know, it was just totally California magic shit. You know, it was amazing.
And then 16 is the opposite side of Orange County, I guess. And like one side you have the sunny ska and the other side you have the reality of the other side of Orange County.
It's like they weren't wrong with calling their album Tragic Kingdom, you know, because like I went to high school on Coachella, right where Disneyland, you know, is. And it's like, you know, that whole tourist area on a harbor and Catella is very nice. And then it was just like grinding poverty and gangs all around it. You know, it was a very violent society. So I think they were right on the money, but I think that we had the experience of literally just being chased through alleys and shit, skateboarding, you know, either by gang members or skinheads. So I didn't have the talent or melody or know-how to do anything other than like, I just wanted like Rape Man and Poison Idea. You know, like,
can't go wrong with Poison Idea. That's like the ultimate DNA.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So I heard that shit and I'm like, well, fuck.
When Georgia Harstark from My Favorite Murder, that podcast was on, when she was on Turned Out a Punk, she grew up in Orange County. And like you're saying, she's like, yeah, I dealt with Nazis. Like it was terrible. Like it was not a great place to grow up for me. And it's funny.
No.
Like you're saying, it is, it's something that I think people have a different conception of until they live there.
You know, I mean, a lot of it was ideal. Like I said, going to see No Doubt and, you know, hanging out at the Huntington Beach Pier and skateboarding. And then there was also, you know, getting jumped by skinheads and your fucking head kicked in. Or gang members walk up to you and just ask who you claim, and they just fucking 10 people beat you up. It was not unheard of for someone to get put in the hospital or attacked for some reason, you know, just for being there. So it was like a violent society in a beautiful, sunny place, at least then. Now I just don't think anyone can afford to live there. So
I think that's the thing with most cities now. Like, I just wonder where, you know, not certainly not where bad things are going to happen to people, but more like even like where are the cheap places to set up a practice space? Like, where are the cheap places for someone to live while they're doing a band and also trying to hold down a job? Like, it feels like cultures being priced out of areas now.
Well, you know, gentrification is a real thing, but it brings all this other stuff. Like, Whole Foods is just an amazing grocery store. That's all I can say, man.
Well, you don't have Trader Joe's up here yet, I'm jealous of that.
Oh, dude. So I got Trader Joe's, Barron's. Barron's is this like kind of high-end little gourmet place. And then, you know, Sprouts, Jimbo's. This is San Diego's a good place to live.
Yeah.
If you like fruit.
And if you like pro wrestling, too. A lot of great pro wrestling from San Diego as well.
I've ever since I came here when I was like 10 years old, I'm just like, I'm gonna live here.
Yeah,
and I did, and here I am, and I will never leave.
You know, it's funny though, because when John Reese was on the show, he talked about how San Diego, in terms of violence at shows and things like that, made LA look like, you know, like a No Doubt show.
Really?
Yeah, he was saying that the skin and shit was so crazy in San Diego when he was growing up.
Oh, well, yeah, the skinheads, they were based here. Are you kidding? The guy Kurt Metzger, the Aryan Nation, was based here, like right up the freeway from me.
Oh, wow.
You know, when we were older, we played with Neurosis on the in Silver and Blood. They brought us on like 3 dates on that tour. And when we came here, I couldn't believe the amount of skinheads. And then it's a hotbed, certain areas of San Diego. So yeah, I like I said, I don't know John, but I admire him. But I could San Diego has a weird rural kind of redneck culture in the suburbs. And then the fact that it has the tension of the border being right there. And the border, you know, with its fucking 20-foot high or 30-foot high fences and all the guns, and this, you know, it brings attention to it. And so I would not doubt it at all.
Yeah, I spent I made a documentary about wrestling. So I spent a lot of time in Tijuana and in San Diego kind of going across. And it's very interesting to kind of like you're saying, there's such a militarized kind of presence on that border that,
yeah,
it makes it, you know, I imagine just people feed into it and become assholes because of the, I don't know. I could definitely feel what you're talking about though.
It's the tension. It's the division. Mm-hmm. It's a border. It's us versus them, no matter what, you know. Mm-hmm. Some of us, I personally think it makes it even better, and not for the violence reasons, for the multicultural reasons, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah. What was it like when you guys went up and played San Francisco back then? Like you mentioned playing at the Gilman. I guess there is that Slap-A-Am scene kind of going on. Would that be kind of the stuff you guys would wind up playing with up there, or is it just typical Gilman?
Yeah, no, we played definitely some quote unquote legendary shows. We play with Dystopia in a warehouse, and it would just be great. And Dino from Dystopia was a good friend. I was friends with his younger brother, so we used to practice in a practice space in Santa Ana, California. And so those guys were always like cooler. They went to my high school. They had like dreads in like 11th grade and shit, and I'd hang around this guy, Steve, that was in, or I'd try to hang around them, who was in, he, I think he was in Phobia for a long time. Steve was like, I'm like, hey, I got a band. And he's like, what is it? Some skater punk stuff. And I was like, no, I like Carcass too. But yeah, we play with Dystopia. We play with all that kind of group up there. We got in some epic shows back then.
It's hilarious right now how this the Dystopia shirt has become like the Thrasher shirt or the Motorhead shirt of this era. Like my brother dropped his daughter off at her elementary school, and there was like a grade four kid wearing a Dystopia shirt that was like, yeah, my parents got me into Crust.
Yeah, that is so funny.
It's so
That's
weird.
awesome.
I guess this is the time we live in now where like all this music that used to be underground is now accessible to everyone in a way. So if it was
You
cool
know
to
what?
us.
It's so funny. So, my son is 19 now, but there was a stage when his friends would come over, and like I saw like a self-made tattoo on my kid's friend's leg of black flag bars,
Yeah.
And then my son's one of his friends was into Infest and Dystopia, and I'm like, how do you hear that? He's like, you do.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh shit. I'm like, well, check this out, kid. My son's like, Dad, leave him alone.
It sucks when my kids' friends come over and they actually think my stories are cool and they want to see the records
Know.
and then my kids are like, Dad, leave us alone. Get the
I know.
fuck
At that stage of fatherhood, where you just go in their room and they're like, "What
Yes.
do you want?"
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
I got that now. I got that now. Like, what do you need? I'm like, I'd say hi.
Yeah, I love
Hi.
you.
Hi. I love you. You turned out so much better than me.
Yes.
Bye.
But that's the thing, I guess, like knowing that they turned out better than you gives you the strength to deal with the fact that they don't want to hang out with you. It's like, well, I wouldn't want to hang out with me either. So,
I'm like, and then it makes me think, I'm like, God, you're so cool.
yeah.
It makes me feel all needy. I'm like, they're so cool. I wouldn't want to hang out with me either.
Yeah, I wrote
Yeah.
to my kid's teacher yesterday. We're writing back and forth about something, and I'm like, yeah, I just got to convince him to hang out with me. And as soon as I send it, I'm like, that sounds so pathetic. Like,
It's so true,
it's
though.
so true.
Dude, it's fucking, it's cats in the cradle all the way.
Yeah. And
Cats in, yeah.
also it's like, you're in 16. Like, you were like a pro skater at as like a little kid. Like, it's fucking cool. But no matter how cool you were, it's almost like the inverse with your kid. It makes you that much
Yep.
dorkier to your kid.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So you just quit trying.
Yeah.
You're like, this is just me. It was cool then.
Yeah.
It's not cool
No. No, but cool now is
now.
Mr. Beast. And, none of us are going to be Mr. Beast. Have you seen Mr.
I don't even
B?
know what Mr. Beast
Oh,
is.
my God.
No.
He is the most watched person on YouTube. And he's just like a dude. Like, he doesn't, like, he plays
Should
Minecraft.
I feel like I should take notes. I'm like, Mr. Beast.
Yeah.
Investigate Mr.
I
Beast.
was at the gym today, and on the screen they had a poker game, a celebrity poker game, and it was Mr. Beast and Ted Cruz playing poker on a celebrity poker
What the
game.
fuck?
But he's just a guy, and he doesn't have anything special. He doesn't know how to play guitar. He doesn't know how to skateboard. He doesn't know how to like any of the things that would have made you cool in a different era. That's not Mr. Beast. He's just a dude who played Minecraft, got a lot of money, and then started giving the money away, and has grown it into like billions and billions of views and millions and millions and millions of dollars. And but the kids, my younger two, think he's the coolest. And I'm just, but what I'm like, what does he do? Like, he's not even that great looking.
Again, I always want to refer back to me trying to explain the germs to my dad.
Yes.
You know, when I'm about to condemn that as, look, this is, I want to sit my son down and go, look, this is fucking nonsense, you know? And then I'm like, no, because remember you were trying to explain how cool Darby Crash was to your 70s father, your fucking 80s dad. So I guess we need to admit we don't know shit ever.
At a certain point, yeah. And I think that's a great thing about this is like, that's why it's cool to always like the underground stuff, because then you never have to worry about, you know, it's always, you're like that meme at the party where the guys in the corner, like, they don't even know about Dystopia at this party. Like, that's how cool we are that we know about all the secrets. Did you ever see Red Cross?
Yeah, I had a bunch, dude. They were like my favorite band.
One of the best.
So I liked hardcore Red Cross, but I really got into them when that guitarist Robert Hecker joined the band. Mm-hmm. And Neurotica. You know, I was like I said, I saw where was the band? They had Don Bowles from The Germs was in it.
Oh,
they did a cover.
Tater Tots? No.
No. They used to open up for Red Cross.
Celebrity Skin?
Google. Thank you. They remember their cover of SOS?
Oh, yeah.
So I saw them open up for Red Cross at like the Celebrity, and there was like, they stole all those McDonald's characters and just put them on stage. And they had a smoke machine, and they had like super long hair and like paisley bodysuits on. And it was just like, that was the most punk shit I've ever seen. Like, you know, they had McDonald's characters everywhere, a heavy smoke machine, Red Cross Neurotica. The guitar playing is still to this day amazing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I loved every, it was like, it was pre-grunge, but they were onto it.
Yeah.
You know, they were a total 70s HR Puff and stuff, but with like big muffs and Marshalls.
They're the band that should have been, you know, like, cause they were the band that if they had been able to take it to that level that Nirvana did, like obviously Nirvana is Nirvana, but when you watch footage of Nirvana playing on a stage, it's just like a band that would have been playing in a club, but playing on a giant stadium stage. Whereas, you know, if it had been Red Cross, there would have been some incredible costumes.
Yeah. Red Cross would have done it.
They would have gone all out. I think they're like, you know, much like I said about 16, they're a band that never got bad. Like, they never put out a bad record. Like, I love Phase Shifter. That's my favorite record by them. I think
that's a great record too. Oh,
never. There's not a bad one in there.
No, there is not.
And they were on
McDonald Brothers are geniuses.
Yeah. And like you're saying with yourself too, they are also people that got into it especially with Steve, crazy young. And so they aged out of it when they were still super young and were able to kind of like, you know, move on to this whole other world that they made.
That they invented.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I don't think they get enough credit for being like ahead of Jane's Addiction, ahead of SST stuff, ahead of grunge, ahead of a bunch of stuff in LA.
This has been unbelievable. And anytime, Bobby, you want to come back on this show and talk about music, the door is always open.
Well, I guess I could always use some press. I don't know, man. Is that how we do this thing? This music thing?
It's how we do it.
It's how we do it.
I think, you know, for a band that has survived and thrived for this long, to not be playing the game, whatever you're doing is working. So just keep doing what you're doing. Don't worry about how you're supposed to be doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm just, like I said, I listened to my LP today and I was like, I should write a better one than that. God. So, you know, I think we'll be around on that premise alone. like a weird insecurity that drives you forward.
That is awesome. Thank you, Bobby, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Bobby will be back because we can all use some press at some point in the future. And whenever he needs that press, we'll be happy to give it to him here at Turned Out of Punk, the press outlet, for better or for worse. But do check out, if I am a press outlet, please let me press upon you to check out 16's Into Dust. All right, coming up on the next episode, Bobby is going to be happy with this one. Coming back to the show, the greatest punk rock siblings in the history of punk. I think we can say that. I think we can, maybe alternative music, maybe rock and roll, maybe music, period. On the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, returning, it is Steven and Jeff McDonald from the band Red Cross. And oh my gosh, is this a good one? This is awesome. If you have not heard Steven McDonald's first episode, first appearance on Turned Out of Punk, or the first time they were on the show together from last year, check those both out in advance. There's a lot of callbacks, but this is a good one. I'm excited for you to hear it. And Bobby's going to be excited too. All right, that is it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different sexual identities and just knock out all, like, different races, knock out all that hatred, knock out all that shit, because we're not talking about politics here. This is just basic human rights. People deserve to be able to live free from violence and oppression. So if there's stuff, organizations, groups in this world that are making a difference and affecting positive change that you feel like you should support, support them. And that can be with your time, that can be with your physical presence, that can be monetarily if you can afford it. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. It's just literally dead weight. Try meditation. Maybe it can help you. It's helped me. Make your own culture. Anyone can do this shit. Go out there, start a band, start a fanzine, do whatever. Just try something. Try something creative. It'll once again, something else that can help you feel better. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.